because of the position of the choke. What really seems to be going on is that he made himself what the equivalent is of a vertical dipole, has the same radiation characteristics, I would say, as a vertical dipole, and his topology seems to suggest that this is sort of akin to a dipole being fed in the center, and that's the reason why he has a good match. And that's the way I'm looking at it, and I think it kind of ties together. Back to Ned, WY2U.
Makes sense to me, Roy.
Yeah, to me as well. I mean, I unfortunately was trying to make that point earlier, and I guess I didn't. What's going on is effectively you're having two dipoles. You are having the center line that is bare for a quarter wavelength, and then you are having this very interesting common mode emission on the outer portion of the coax shielding. So it's effectively, it is end fed, but it works as a dipole. That's why way back at the beginning of all this, I said that the name was problematic, but the design kind of warrants that confusion, because it's both center, it's both end-fed and a dipole. Now, some people get end-feds completely confused and call all end-fed half-waves dipoles for some strange reason, but this really seems to me to be a dipole that happens to be fed at the end. So I would agree with you, Mike.
Yep, that's the way I'm looking at it, too, and that's the only explanation that would make sense that would imply that this type of topology has a good match. So I think if you work out the current distribution, and I can probably do this with EasyNeck if I spend some time on it, I think you'd probably find out that the current maximum appears close to where the center choke is. Even though it doesn't seem to make sense, but if that's the current maximum, you got yourself a half-wave dipole. WY2U.
KD2FIU.
George recognized, I just want to make a comment to Mike because he's a maven with NEC. It was my understanding that NEC is not very well designed to use coaxial cables in common mode. My understanding is that they are designed in the software to be relatively simplistic, lossless, non-radiating conductors. And there might be a way of fudging it by adding extra wires into the frame. But am I correct in that assumption or terribly wrong?
No, I think you're right. that's an issue that needs to be explored. But what I'm going to try to do if I get some time tomorrow is try to model this thing on an antenna modeling program and see if I'm right about where the current seems to be maximum. And that would, of course, imply that it is indeed a dipole structure. Go ahead.
I would love to see a picture of that. If you do it, please send me a copy. Ed, back to you. George, I think, wants to say something.
KG2RY.
Yes, George and David. I'm just wondering, just an academic curiosity. Like I said before, imagine a 2-meter vertical mag mount on the car. You have a quarter wave radiator, the body of the car, and the coax all act like a large ground plane that's nowhere near quarter wave. It's much, much, much larger. And I'm wondering, can you extend that to this antenna and consider the coax outer shield to be something of a large ground plane, like the body of the car? And might it be not elegant, but might be sloppy and dirty, but actually work if you leave out the choke? It's an academic exercise, that's all. I'm just wondering, maybe I'll just try it one of these days and see how the SWR comes out. How about George, then David?
KD2FIU. I just turned on a few minutes ago and I'm hearing about verticals. One of the best antennas I have ever worked is the GAP for HF. And I determined it was a capacitive and fed off-centered vertical dipole. The base of the antenna was fed by the shield of the coax directly. The capacitor vertical rods, then fed to a center. That center is not the portion of dipole. That center is now feeding the top with a high-powered capacitor at the top. It's an end-fed capacitive vertical dipole. And there are rods on the sides of the antenna to give you the bands to tune with. Two of the four models of gap antennas are like that. The Eagle and the Titan. They are capacitive end-fed off-centered vertical dipoles. And they work incredibly well. KD2FIU.
Okay, George, that just sounds like a very elaborate and expensive antenna. This one is to see just how cheap and dirty you can get away with it. David?
QSL, Ed, I agree with you. Instead of having 16 feet or 6 inches of lead and then just remove all that braid from there, you could peel that shielded, braided shield. You can peel it back 16 feet, 16 inches. You can make it vertical. You can make it horizontal, you know. Maybe there's a way to seal, you know, so that weather doesn't get into it. Back to you, sir.
All right, David. Yeah. That's an interesting point. An antenna like this is going to have a lot of problems with rain. Back to Roy, WB2AV.
Well, I think that's the point of that thermoplastic cone-shaped object at the end of the coax cable to both the strain relief and probably a degree of weather protection. But that's probably its weakest point. I could see that eventually just coming undone. So someone will have to come up with something a little bit more, clever than a little piece of thermoplastic cone.
NY2H.
KG2RY.
Oh, Ben Dave.
All right, my question still stands. How is the shield portion of the quarter wave radiating? Is the current being induced somehow?
Yes.
I think Russell Paul, WY2U, gave the best explanation we've heard on that.
So that would be similar to your ground plane theory with the vertical end, Ed, right? Just be total indulgent. It's just the other end. The thing that it bounces off of, you know, the thing that's pushing the swing, as Dick would say.
There is no answer, Key. We're all spitballing ideas here.
Is it a simple counterpoise?
No, I don't think so. This is WY2U.
Yeah, I think it's just a dipole. It's the leg of a dipole. It just happens to be operating in common mode. It's going through its differential mode until it reaches the end of the coax, and then it's reflecting back in common mode and then being choked.
I think that's the best explanation right there, Roy.
Got it, Roy.
Could I short it out at the end where it comes to a single wire, where the coax ends and the wire continues for another quarter wave? Could I short that out if it's in common mode?
Negative.
It'd work if you did that. It wouldn't reflect back.
Negative. You would lose dipole form.
Is it capacitively coupled from the inner wire to the shield? In other words, the inner wire, the first quarter wave, half of that dipole, which we're saying is center fed, where it's stripped, is that, and Roy's calling it common mode. So are we suggesting that the inner wire is capacitively coupled, which it would be, right? Coax, you have capacitors and inductors, right? It's the simple circuits inside of them. And that's the method of which the current is occurring on that shield?
Probably more complicated than just capacitive coupling. It's electromagnetic coupling. So you have a magnetic field and electric field. And they are equal approximately to the same magnitude as the current that flows in the topmost center conductor.
Okay, I like that. I like that answer. I think I can live with that. Okay.
Let me take this opportunity to thank Mike very much. I found your contributions to be extremely interesting. You know, I just figured this is a nice, easy thing, and let's just kick around some ideas, and thank you so much. WB2 Heavy.
KG2RY.
Dave, go ahead.
How does a person weatherproof this thing? Whether the braided shield is peeled back, or whether it's set up as it is in the diagram, there's this company called Calumet. They make dipoles that have trap dipole, and the antenna itself and the traps are coated with some kind of titanium plastic. You know, I'm wondering if there's some kind of liquid weatherproofing you can put on this antenna.
My take is there are a lot of things you can do. The idea is to make sure that rain doesn't get down, run down into a coax between the shield and the insulator for the center wire. That would not be good if you got rain down there, because I don't think it would easily evaporate, and then it would corrode, it would change the impedance. Yeah.
Yeah, I know. You could probably wrap some kind of silicon weatherproofing tape on it, but you know, I'm sure that over time some water probably would seep in.
Yeah, but there are many ways to prevent that. I'm just saying, don't gloss over that if you ever try to build this antenna yourself. That's all.
QSL, maybe there's a way to soak the entire antenna in some kind of weatherproofing, so then when it hardens, it's a permanent protection.
I have an idea. Put the whole thing in spar varnish and use it as a mast on your sailboat.
Yeah, but you know, you give us this example for an antenna. We're wondering, like, you know, I really kind of consider doing this for myself.
David, I think the intention of this antenna is to hang it vertically down from some support point. That is the one thing, from what I know about your QTH, ain't gonna happen.
QSL, and you know I love dipole antennas from the very beginning, you know. Dipoles are king.
I'm just saying, putting this antenna up on the flat roof of an apartment building, it's kind of hard to find a skyhook to hang it from.
Yeah, it depends on how long the antenna is. There are parts that are higher up than other parts, but, you know, how do I get up there?
Yeah, that's an interesting challenge.
QSL, 100 watts and a vertical dipole. Fantastic.
And if you do something wrong and you're over the side, how far down is it?
I don't know, maybe 25, 30 feet, I don't know.
I mean, you're over the side of the building.
115 feet, something like that.
Yeah, kids, don't try this one at home.
Maybe I could just tie it to a tree. I could get a drone and hang it from a tree.
There are no trees on the roof of your building.
The trees are all around.
None of them are higher than the building, are they?
Yeah, yeah, some of them are. The ones in near the courtyard are maybe 30 or 40 feet higher than the building.
And do you need Peter Pan to fly between the two?
I'll get the super to throw a baseball with a rope attached to it.
Alright, I think this is degraded enough, Roy.
Okay, Doug, thank you so much, Ed. I appreciate your efforts. I thought it was an interesting design. I thought we could talk about it. I don't think it's a diagrammatically simple design. It's a much more technologically complicated one, as you and Mike and Lou discussed. So it is fascinating. I would love to hear if you plan on actually doing any experiments. I really look forward and hope Mike can design an NEC simulation of it. Again, I would have tried, but you got to know a lot of very, very esoteric NEC tricks in order to get coax cables to have common mode in simulators. So I thank you and all the people that participated in this conversation, and I hope that we can do something like this in the future, Ed. So please, if your interests are piqued by any article or news story or what have you, let me know.
NY2H, quick comment.
Yes, Lou.
You were speculating at the beginning of the net if Ed's presentation at the club last week was up on YouTube. Yes, it is. So if you go to the Limark YouTube channel, it's the latest edition. You'll see Ed's presentation.
Ah, very good. I look forward to watching it. I sat in on one of Ed's presentations on radio receivers at HRU and enjoyed it immensely, and I look forward to the YouTube.
Boy, it's the same one.
What the hell? I like reruns. I've read Lord of the Ring at least four times.
Okay, that's good.
KG2R1.
WS2N.
Yes, David, and then Paul.
Ed, I just wanted to tell you, when I was a novice and I was looking for materials to build antennas, you know, some guy sold me a box of wire for $5. It had coax, it had all kinds of stuff in there, you know, and your conversation makes me think about that.
Yeah, but that was so long ago, that $5 to buy you a car.
No, I think that was 1910.
Just kidding.
Yes, Paul.
Okay, Roy. Yeah, I wanted to tell Ed it was a great presentation. I was one of the Zoom people. And it sounds like you're going to have a part two next April. Is that true, Ed? Not next month, May.
Yeah, that's what WB2YKT told me he has in mind. And, no, it was originally a much longer presentation, so I told George that I'd probably do the HF part this time. And I still have the other half to go, which is the VHF-UHF part. And keep in mind, in 45 or 50 minutes, there's a limit to how much down in the down rabbit holes I can go. But it was well received at HRU.
Okay, well, it was well received at Limark as well. Okay, Roy, over to you.
Okay, very good. I tell you, Ed, though, I was a little confused. You know, I'm one of those guys who actually reads the newsletter, and I read the description, which made absolutely no sense to me at all. The description in the newsletter was that you were going to discuss radios all the way from World War II to the invention of, I think, super heterodyne receivers. And since super heterodyne receivers was patented in around the time of World War One, not World War Two, I was very confused by the time stream.
Let me walk with a question when I have a chance.
Go ahead. Somebody say you have a question?
K2MUF, I really appreciate it. I got a lot of coax from some, power pole cables. And it seems strange that the connectors are vertical instead of horizontal. In other words, the red's on top of the black, not side by side.
Not sure I understand that. Let's put on that maybe Royal wants to say something. Let me stop saying about the thing. Roy, you asked a question about the description. I had nothing to do with that description at all. To tell you the truth, I didn't even see it, and if I had, it would have been too late to do anything about it. But do not think I had any participation in that, so don't blame me, Roy. Now, you want to address that question? I'm not sure.
Well, I'm not quite sure what the question is. Keep in mind that we're already running late, and we really should go to the SpaceNet report. And I never blamed you, Ed. I was just deeply confused by the description, and I assumed some third party had kind of taken the words and thrown them in a Scrabble type of machine and reconstituted them. So I never thought it came from you. I'm not quite sure the call sign, KW2OF. Could you rephrase the question? And if it's a short one, we'll try.
Hey, it is short. The call is Kilo 2, Mike, Uniform, Foxtrot, maximum usable frequency. Name is Joe. I got power pole cables from somebody, and the connectors, instead of being the black and red side by side, they are vertical. The red is on top of the black. That's how they were configured.
Yeah, you can do that. Roy, should I say something there?
Yeah, sure. You have a better idea about this than I do, so please.
Yeah, on a non-ham radio application, I needed some high current connectors, and I said, I know, I've seen all the stuff on power poles used in the ham radio stuff. So I linked into it and I used the power pole connectors. And you can put them together horizontally, vertically, or even in a four-way piece. So you can mount them any way you want. They do slide apart. But like you said, I believe a ham radio, great power, they are side by side. But there's no reason why they can't be mounted vertically, and I believe with a little bit of oomph, assuming that there's no mechanical strain relief that prevents you from doing this, you can separate them, put it back together any way you want.
Thank you very much. This is K2MUF, just standing by listening. Thank you for the answer. I noticed it probably is for some other configuration other than ham radio. K2MUF is standing by.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Thank everyone. I had a great time. I hope everyone had a great time. And now, although it's a little on the late side, please, time for pool WS2N with the SpaceNet report.
No problem, Roy. And this is the TechNet, so, as far as I'm concerned, the tech part could go on all night long. I could always follow up with a lot of these space topics anytime next week or whatever. Anyway, as far as the launches and landing segment, I always start off with that. There's a landing coming up, and it will be they call it the Axiom 1 commercial mission that's coming back, and that they're going to be doing a splashdown, most likely in the Atlantic, but if there's waves out there, they could also change and land in the Gulf of Mexico. And they have SpaceX recovery ships in both locations. So anyway, a crew of four is going to be coming back. It's the first commercial crew that was ever launched that docked with the space station. They had a commercial crew go up with four people in it last year, and that was the Inspiration mission. But that just, you know, orbited the Earth, never docked to the space station. This one had plans of docking. NASA approved it, and these four people are collectively paid millions of dollars to SpaceX to do that. And then, from what I understand, money was also transferred to NASA to do this as well. So, you know, for time being, over 10 days, they had a 10-day mission. 8 of those days were aboard the space station. They figured out places to sleep. They don't have enough bunks to do that for 11 people, but they always manage. There's four regular spots for the American side, and there's three spots on the Russian side, and then they have a new permanent location on the Columbus module, and then somebody else also slept in there, and then they had another spot in the Quest module as well. That's the one that they normally would use to do an EVA, but they weren't doing any EVAs, so they set that person up there. But anyway, they're going to be returning this week, Wednesday. They'll be landing in the Atlantic Ocean, hopefully successfully, in the morning, 7:19 a.m. So I try to catch it live. If not, of course, they have repeats. You always watch that on NASA. Or YouTube, you bring up YouTube NASA. There's going to be a launch a couple of days later on Saturday morning, 7:26 a.m. You have a regular NASA crew going up. And this is, of course, a long-term visit when they send a crew of four up now on the Dragon spacecraft launched by the Falcon 9. This time you have a mission specialist, Jessica Walkins. It'll be the first flight for her. Bob Hines, he's been up before. You have Jell Lindbergh. He's a ham, but he's going to be the commander. And then you also have another mission specialist, Samantha Cristoforetti. And she's got the call sign IZ0UDF. Second trip for her. She comes out of Italy. Of course, you can tell from the call sign. But second trip for Samantha. And last time she was up there for like 6 months, and she's going to do another 6 months. So I think that's great. And then they will be the crew that actually replaces another crew that's already up there. So it's generally 7 people. Of course, once in a while, they will now have 11. But in general, it's a 7-person crew on the International Space Station. For years, it was 6. But ever since Dragon started flying, they could fly 4 people up. And that's the regular contingent for the ISS. Total of 7 people. You have a lot of people flying in space. I mean, you had another crew that just came back from the Chinese space station, and they had 3 there. So for a period of time, you had 14 people flying in space. Amazing. Okay, I wanted to talk about balloons. Believe it or not, NASA has a balloon program. And it's called HASP is the name of it. And it stands for the High Altitude Student Platform. What they do is students from around the country and sometimes around the world will have projects that they need to launch. And they'll launch maybe up to 10 or 12 experiments that they'll put on this balloon platform, HASP. They launch it with a balloon, and in this case from New Mexico. And they'll fly for, you know, 10, 15, 20 hours. They'll go to the stratosphere, and they do this on a regular basis. I think this is around the 16th time that NASA has done this. And it's in conjunction with a Wallops Island facility. They have a Wallops Island balloon program. And then they have Louisiana's involved, and different places around the country. Texas, of course. But we'll see how this one goes. It's going to be launched very shortly. But, you know, sometimes they'll put amateur radio equipment on board if they want to test something out on these things. And I put a picture, Roy put it up for me on his website. It's not exactly what I wanted to have. For some reason, the picture was oversized. I tried shrinking it, which I did shrink it, but when I sent it on email, it still came up gigantic. And then there was a second picture with the actual balloon in the background, which I really wanted to put on, because what you're looking at on the picture that's there now is the HASP unit itself, and they have it, with cables stretched over this hydraulic lift, and that's actually the launch vehicle. So this thing just like dangles down with all the experiments on it, and when the balloon comes up, the balloon will actually take it off this hydraulic lift, and it will pull it up, straight, so it's hanging vertical the whole time, right before launch. For some reason that picture didn't come out. Anyway, what it really is the hydraulic lift with the, they suspend the HASP unit, going to be flying, and then the balloon is set behind it. And these balloons blow up to, hundreds of feet in diameter when they go up with the helium balloons. So I hope it's successful. There's sometimes thousands of students involved with this, all involved with the STEM program. And they've been doing it since, 2006. So here we are, all these years later, still doing it. Let me drop it for any questions before I move on. Okay, here's a topic I wanted to get to last week, but I didn't do it. Amazon signed a multi-billion-dollar contract. I think it's going to be tens of probably $15 billion by the time they finish. Amazon wants to put up a similar broadband system that SpaceX is doing. SpaceX has launched thousands of satellites for their Starlink program. But Amazon, as we have done, has the Kuiper program, and which will eventually consist of 3,235 satellites that they plan on putting into space. And right now they haven't launched any. But Amazon wants to do this within, maybe 4 or 5 years total. But to do it, they need to pretty much start immediately. So he signed a contract with three different groups. One group is New Glenn, which is basically the same guy. Amazon is owned by Jeff Bezos, and New Glenn is owned by Blue Origin. Blue Origin is a spinoff of Amazon, so it's basically the same group. But anyway, that particular rocket, New Glenn, hasn't been launched yet. It's going to be almost as tall as a Saturn V rocket that took astronauts to the moon. Now that rocket has not launched yet. They wanted to launch by the end of the year. It looks like they're going to have their first launch maybe early next year. Then they made a contract with many more of our launches on the Ariane 6 rocket. We're talking about, 40, maybe 30, 40 launches each. It's going to be a total of 83 launches to launch all these over 3,000 satellites. And that's why it's going to be a $10 billion plus program. But he wants to launch on the Ariane 6 rocket. Ariane 6 is built by European Space Agency. They launch out of French Guiana, out of Kourou, French Guiana. They've been launching since the 1970s over there. But the latest Ariane rocket that they've been using, which is their heavy lift rocket, is the Ariane 5. And they've had 80 more successful launches so far, but over the years they've been developing the Ariane 6, and that should come online again, maybe the first launch by the end of this year. But maybe not. Anyway, here's another rocket that's never been launched before. And then you have a third one by United Launch Alliance, ULA. That's a consortium of Boeing and Lockheed. They work together on the UAL launches. They've launched mostly NASA satellites over the years. And they put all the communication satellites up for NASA, for the government, National Reconnaissance Orbit, to put geosynchronous satellites up. And they've always used the Atlas V or the Delta rockets, the Delta 4 or the Delta 4 Heavy. Before that, they used to use the Delta 2s and different rockets. Anyway, ULA is another organization, and they have the up-and-coming Vulcan Centaur rocket. Vulcan is designed to replace the Atlas V. Years ago, when Russia invaded the Crimea area, there was all kinds of problems, and let's get away from the, buying Russian engines. The Atlas V has RD-180 engines, which are built by Russia. So let's do away with them. Let's sign up another group, sort of the two engines that were in competition, one by Aerojet and then another one by Blue Origin, which is Jeff Bezos. And he was building the methane BE-4 engine, which one, so they plan on putting two of these monster engines in the up-and-coming Vulcan rocket. So here's another rocket that has not flown yet, due to fly, definitely, I think that one's going to fly definitely by the end of this year, unless there's problems. But here's a satellite system of over 3,000 satellites. Not one has been put into space yet by Jeff Bezos with Amazon, not one. And he's got this plan of doing this. And, he signs a multi-billion-dollar contract for 83 launches with three rockets that haven't even launched yet. So say that the space industry is becoming larger, bigger, gambling more on success is an understatement. Any questions or comments? WS2S. Okay, now, because of all of this, is a company, Aerojet. I mentioned before, Aerojet has been around forever. They make the hydrogen oxygen rockets for NASA space shuttle. The RS-25 engines, and they make a lot of different engines. Anyway, they got a contract for 116 engines to be built. And their engines are for the second stage of these rockets. They're called the RL-10C now. RL-10C has been around for decades, different variations of it over the years. And, puts out around 25,000 pounds of thrust. And it's used on a second stage for Atlas V rockets, for the Delta IV upper stage. So they've launched over 400, I think it's close to 500 second stages successfully. And very, very well-built, very successful engine. Anyway, they got an order for 116 of these things. And part of the reason is all the flights that are going to be done by Jeff Bezos with Amazon for the Kuiper broadband communication system. So we'll be looking forward to see how they do as well. But, you have at least that's a tried and done system. Most of the fact, all of the Atlas V rockets have launched with one RL-10C engine on it, except for one, and that was the Starliner a couple of years ago. They tried to launch the Starliner on an Atlas V rocket to dock with the International Space Station. The Starliner is going to be a crewed vehicle, which will eventually carry four people, just like the Dragon does today, up to the International Space Station. Back in 2019, December, when they tried to do this, Boeing and Lockheed, United Launch Alliance, launched the Atlas V rocket. It had successfully, gotten to orbit and using the second stage. And the second stage, like I said, normally carried one RL-10 liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen engine rocket to push the to whatever the payload is into orbit. But because the Starliner is so big, so heavy, for human space travel, they needed two of those engines. So that one, that's the only one that had two on the second stage, which gives them a total of a little over 50,000 pounds of thrust for that stage. And it's got a big tank, so it could run long. It could reignite many times, multiple times. So it's reliable. And again, that was one of the flights that they had that. Now all the flights that go up on the Vulcan rocket are also going to have two of these engines that, it's got a Starliner attached to it. And hopefully, if that's successful, that's going to launch 1 month from now, May 19th, from Launch Complex 41 down in Florida, just like last time. Hopefully, it makes it dock to the space station to be able to open a hatch to prove that on board the space station we'll be able to go inside, poke around, reach okay. It'll stay attached probably for a week or so, and then eventually deorbit and land on land. The reason this one is so important, this one actually does land on land, as opposed to the Dragon, which lands a splash down at sea. This actually comes down and right at the very end, right before it hits the surface of the land, it has these airbags that, pop out to soften the blow. Anyway, they plan on landing on a regular basis in New Mexico. And we'll see. I mean, it was successful last time, 2 years ago. Even so, they didn't make it to the International Space Station. All kinds of computer problems, because of that, they ran low on fuel. They decided to deorbit, and sure enough, they landed properly in New Mexico with these airbags. So they know that system works. So it should be interesting. All they need to do is get to the space station, stay there for a few days, and then return, and then you can start putting crews on Starliner. And by the way, Starliner is built by Boeing, that's their contract. Any questions or comments? WS2. Okay, another interesting company I've been following, of course, is Rocket Lab. Rocket Lab launches right now out of New Zealand. Peter Beck owns that, and he's an American contractor. He's always born in New Zealand. Rocket engines are built in California, and he launches from his home country in New Zealand on the North Island, and he's successfully done this over 20 times, and he's been looking to have reusable first stages similar to what they do with SpaceX, and his system's a little different. He's not going to have a propulsive landing, on a barge or come back to land. But he's got a system of having a parachute open up, it's going to come down, through the through the atmosphere. You know, the first stage actually makes it to space, like 80 miles up, and then it re-enters the atmosphere. And he's got some kind of heat shield on it, and not going to slow it down. He's going to try to make it come down pretty much horizontally to try to, instead of, you know, that drop vertically, to try to reduce the amount of heat at one time that hits the vehicle. And he's done this successfully so far. He comes down, and then he's got a parachute that opens up, and so far, I think three of them so far have landed in the water. And he picks them up and brings them back. He doesn't reuse them because they get damaged with the salt water. So his idea is to catch this thing out of the sky with a helicopter. So he's got this Sikorsky helicopter. It's a stretch helicopter. But it's pretty large, you know. But he's got this helicopter that's going to, as it's coming down, it's got a hook on it. He's gonna hook onto the cable, and then that helicopter, he'll be able to bring it back to land. And then if that works out, he'll be able to reuse the first stage. So looking forward to see how Rocket Lab does with their ability to for reusability. They've got these nine engines, they're called Rutherford engines. They all run on batteries, you know, the engines. They have, you know, all these rocket engines have turbines on them. The turbine's job is to pump a tremendous amount of fuel and liquid oxygen into these rocket chambers. So he's got nine engines on the first stage, and each one has its own fuel pumps, and each one has a motor to drive those fuel pumps. On your conventional rocket, you usually have, like, the exhaust, for instance, from the rocket's system that would drive the turbines, and turbines are used to pump the fuel in the oxidizer, liquid oxygen. This guy had the idea to run motors, 50 horsepower motors, to drive each pump. He's got these lithium ion batteries. And when they use up, as they're going up, lithium ions, you know, wind up draining as the flight is going up for the first 2.5 minutes. He actually jettisons these batteries as they're going up, and then picks up these other batteries for continual operation of the rocket. That's why he calls his rocket the Electron rocket. Nothing to do with electrons, but because it runs. Runs the turbos on electricity. So we'll see how Peter Beck does with his Electron rocket by Rocket Lab for reusability. Any comments, questions? WS.
Hey, sorry to break in. KD2PPF listening from Colorado via Echolink, and it just seemed like everything dropped out. Is the net still running, or was there a problem? Over.
KD2BBF, well, that does happen sometimes. I don't know if we have problems recently or not. But I don't know, Roy or maybe Lou know. You guys know what the status is on Echo?
Well, I don't hear Lou yet. It's sort of the same thing. It has a exceeded TX limit, and then the audio drops for a little while.
Yeah, it sounds like he's lost us all together, though.
That time complete.
I guess that's the best answer we can get to you. KD2BBF, I think it was WS2N.
Paul
is my name, by the way. Glad you're listening from Colorado. I love Colorado. I worked there a couple of years. There were different locations near Denver. Great place. Okay, any questions or comments so far? WS2N.
KG2RY.
Yes, Dave, go ahead.
I have a question.
You know, if you're standing next to the 5G tower, you can get 5G service. But if you're indoors and the signal cannot penetrate the walls, the windows, or objects, you know, are you really using 4G? And my question is, you know, what is happening where certain signals come from other places that allow for GPS to penetrate the walls, windows, and objects? Could you elaborate?
Okay, that's usually up to Roy's technical part of the net. We're just trying to cover the space program. And so, you know, I'm sure Roy will get to it sooner or later, maybe after the net, or well, if I run too long, probably next week, Dave. But I know they're going to have Wi-Fi on the moon. If you want to talk about that, there's actually plans that we're working on how they're going to interconnect all the robotic equipment and the and all the manned spacecraft that will be landing eventually at base on the moon with 5G. You have robots going all over the place, little rovers, unmanned, some manned, and they definitely plan on using 5G. I have read that. So, Dave, we'll have to get back to you on that, okay?
QSO. And, yes, it is related to space. And I'll ask you the same question next week.
Real fine, Dave. Very good. Just want to cover the James Webb Space Telescope, which I've been covering here for probably for years. That was launched Christmas Day of last year. So spent a month, over a month, getting to its location, the Lagrange Point 2, 1 million miles away from Earth, four times the distance away from the orbit of the moon. And it's spent the next, who knows how many months, we're already up, almost up to May, but they spent the time calibrating everything, trying to align the mirrors. Each mirror has to be individually aligned to distance of less than a human hair, each mirror, to try to, you know, get this thing all focused. Everything has worked perfectly. All the different steps that they trained for years have come back exactly what they thought, if not slightly better. For the last couple of weeks or month, they've been trying to bring the instruments online. There's four main instruments. They all copy the signals on in infrared and different wavelengths, if they're near infrared. And anyway, there's one called the MIRI, or the mid-infrared instrument. And that's the one that they really have to get down to a very low temperature. The other ones could operate, you know, maybe 30, 40 degrees Kelvin. And this thing has to, for this range, because it's a longer wavelength, and the other ones have to get down to below 7 degrees Kelvin. So sure enough, they got down to 6.6, I think, which is where they wanted to go. They said it went by the book. I mean, they've practiced this dozens and dozens of times on Earth, and they managed to do that. At that location, you know, you could have a sunshade as big as the tennis court, and you could have, everything set up where you're going to get that temperature down, but you're only going to get down to around 40 degrees, 30, maybe 38 degrees Kelvin. To do the rest, to get down to that below 7 degrees Kelvin, they needed a refrigeration unit. And so they used a cascade cryo cooler, they call it. Cryo cooler, so the cascade system is like you have an air conditioner where they have another air conditioner to cool down. You know, you have evaporators and condensers. each time you do it, with different systems, you could bring it down to lower temperatures with this cascading system. And they're using helium for refrigerant. And, you know, which sounds weird, you know, but they've actually done this for many, many years. Even on Long Island, they have Brookhaven National Lab, you have the RIC program, the Relativistic Heavy Ion Super Collider on the grounds of Brookhaven Lab. And before that, it was called Isabel, but that really never took off. But anyway, the RIC program did, and they used liquid helium for that system too. And they've used it around the globe. I would imagine they're using it for Large Hadron Collider in Geneva as well. Anyway, they put it on a spacecraft, and the unit itself, I don't know, it looks kind of large from the pictures I've seen, you know, maybe about five feet tall, 3 feet wide. All kinds of electronic boxes hooked up to it. Anyway, that's part of the bus, or the main part of the James Webb Space Telescope, and that is mounted on the hot side of the vehicle. You know, you have a hot side, which is probably around 130 some odd degrees facing the sun, and then on the opposite side, that's where you're in the shade, and you get down to 40 some odd degrees Kelvin. But now you got to drive this one location where the charge couple device that's going to read the infrared waves. You have to get that to below 7 degrees Kelvin. So that's where essentially the evaporator is, where they have the junction where you're changing from the high pressure side to the low pressure side. And then sure enough, everything worked, and they've driven that temperature down to what they need. Now all they have to do is run some more tests. They know that particular detector is going to work. The other ones, they don't need to have that system, but they need to bring them online as well. Now, why do you need infrared system to look at these galaxies from billions of miles away? If you look at the galaxies that are closer, of course you don't need that. You know, it'll show up somewhat visible light. If you look at the Andromeda galaxy, you know, you can see it with your eyes if you really got good eyes, but telescope or binoculars, you can see it. You're not looking at it with infrared, you're looking at it with a regular light. But the galaxies that they want to look at the beginning of time, 13.8 billion years ago, over the years, because the universe has actually stretched out, the universe is expanding. They all started out, with regular light, but now the universe has stretched out. Those waves are stretching out as well. So those waves have become longer and longer and longer. If you look back at it, in regular light, you're not going to see it. But in infrared, you will see it. But the problem is we can't see it in infrared, so we use these machines to see that infrared wave when it finally reaches here after traveling 13 billion years and hitting our detector, and then of course we convert that, and we'll be able to see these beautiful pictures of long, long ago. Essentially, these look like time machines. Should be interesting. They expect the first light come up probably in May. I'm going to guess the end of May. They're going to look at a few stars and, check out this, check out that, and make sure everything's calibrated, and then I'm sure they'll look at something probably very dazzling, something that's going to make the news. People won't want to hear about a $10 billion machine that's going to look at a star that was, not too far away. I mean, this is, it's going to be a breakthrough instrument. Any questions or comments before I turn it over to Roy?
Yeah, Paul.
Hello, Roy.
Hi there. EchoLink just popped back into existence. I was trying to kick it in the teeth and wake it up. I guess I should have transmitted. Who would figure? Anyway, they've been down for about 10 minutes, unfortunately, and I've been doing all kinds of little things. Did you discuss HD1, or were you just generally discussing